Hi there, and welcome back to Crypto Clarified. This is a podcast series where we clarify crypto. We take the most captivating headlines and trends from the crypto space, we break them down for you, explain what's really going on to help you better understand what is a fast-moving and complicated space to follow. My name is Benjamin Dean, and I'm director in WisdomTree's digital assets team. Today, I'm joined by one of my esteemed colleagues, Mirv Antila, director of digital assets research at WisdomTree. For today's show, we're going to cover a lot of macro and the outlook for the next 6 months or so. Mirv is going to explain to us why macro matters for the crypto space. We're going to think a little bit about what potential catalysts there might be for the market to shift. We're going to talk the relationship between US T-bills and Ethereum staking. And then we're going to finish up, as always at the end, thinking about the future, because we love thinking about the future on this show. Before we start, US listeners, check out wisdomtreeprime.com on the Apple or Android app stores. Hit subscribe and share. Make your lives easier. You'll get the show whenever it's released if you do so. And as always, you can find me on the Bird app at Benjamin Dean. Before we start in earnest, we do need to do the shout out to James and Sam in compliance, though, and it is the best part of the episode, so strap yourselves in. Before we begin, I need to say the following to clarify: the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of WisdomTree and subject to change. Anything we present in this podcast is not intended to be relied upon as a forecast, research, nor as investment or tax advice. The information and opinions expressed in this podcast are not a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any securities, and reliance upon them is at the sole discretion of the listener. Please remember, past performance is no indication of future results. All right, now we're on to the fun stuff. Mirv, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Ben. Good to be with you.
Now, it's been a busy few months on your end. This space is always shifting quickly and changing. And part of your role at WisdomTree is to help investors make sense of this rapidly changing space. What are some of the kind of topics you've been looking at recently as you've helped people understand the space?
Yeah, so just in the past month or so, we wrote this Outlook piece. We've also covered some of the topics on what the drivers could be for Bitcoin and Ethereum longer term. We believe that we're still very much in the sort of large cap crypto season, where those two assets, they've been doing very well this year, and we expect that to continue. We don't see any reasons why that might be that might change at this point. We're also looking at sort of macro factors. Liquidity has been one of the key catalysts in the past, we believe. I'm also looking at the regulation, of course. That's very important. What's going on, particularly with the US regulation, looking at the integration of TradFi to crypto. There are some interesting developments there. And of course, also having an eye on some of the potential negatives that might appear in the industry. So you have to kind of keep a track on those as well.
All right, so busy times. There's plenty for us to unpack there. Let's do each one for the listener's sake. Macro matters. What is it? Why does macro matter for this crypto space?
Yeah, so what we have seen historically really is that the both interest rates and global liquidity, particularly the global liquidity, has been very important. We look at the US M2 money supply and, of course, also the global central banking money supply. And actually, the U.S. money supply was still negative in August. We also look at the Bloomberg Liquidity Index, which looks at the Federal Reserve's reverse repos, which typically is a sign of how much central bank is injecting liquidity into the market. And both of those factors have been negative this year. Just in the past 2 weeks or so, the Bloomberg Liquidity Index has turned up a little bit. But of course, because it's such a short time, we can't really say that that's a trend yet. But there are some early signs that the liquidity situation could be improving. Of course, just in general, when interest rates go up, that is negative for the crypto space, or typically for long-term assets such as crypto or high-tech equities. That's because the if you look at the traditional discounted cash flow model, you would have to discount the futures cash flows with a higher interest rate. So that's really the reason. And because we're kind of in this higher for a longer environment, we believe that unless the liquidity and the interest rate trend or the direction changes, we probably won't see significant improvement in the crypto prices sort of in the short term, unless a really significant catalyst emerges. But so short term, we're slightly cautious. We see some technical headwinds for the industry. Short term really means for the next month or 3 months. And then we need to see the industry, what happens again, and reevaluate. But longer term, we still remain bullish on the sector.
Just as a side note, would it be accurate? I'm thinking back to the Bitcoin Genesis block, Chancellor on the brink of second bailouts. So is it accurate to say then it goes into quantitative easing mode, there's liquidity splashing around everywhere, and the Bitcoin and other crypto things act like a sponge to that. When there's more money just around, then it the space, and it was mostly Bitcoin for the first decade, but the space can kind of soak that liquidity up. Is that close to correct?
Yes, I agree with that. Yes, I would definitely agree with that. So if we see, I mean, some investors are expecting a change in the liquidity flows, and if that's kind of if those spigots open up again, that could be positive for the sector.
Okay, let's turn to the term you used just now, catalysts. So it's been kind of each month I have to write up short reports on what's going on in the crypto space. Very, very short, like let's say 200 words. And the last 3 to 4 months, really some of the only things I can say is it's very quiet, like eerily quiet for a space that historically has been so volatile. When you say catalyst for change, is that the kind of thing where there's an event that occurs that kind of shakes the market? It could be one way, it could be up or down, but just clarify that a little bit for the listeners when we're talking about catalysts for the market.
Sure. So if we think for the next 3 to 6 months to a year, at the moment, probably the most significant positive catalyst would be the approval of a spot Bitcoin ETF in the US. We have already Bitcoin futures, also leveraged Bitcoin futures in the US, but US doesn't yet have a spot Bitcoin product and or ETF product. And this would be very, very positive because we believe that the products that we have in the market at the moment, whether you speak about futures, which suffer from rolling costs, so you have to sell the front month future and buy a further month future, typically when the price goes up, that those further month futures are higher in price, so you incur rolling costs. So that's not a very efficient way to track a spot product, a spot Bitcoin price. We also have closed-end products at the moment in the market, which are quite expensive. You can't trade them sort of freely. And at the moment, actually since 2021, I believe they've been trading at a discount to net asset value. So that's definitely not a great solution. And then there are some other ways to gain exposure into Bitcoin. Some people are using some companies which have sort of high amounts of Bitcoin in their treasuries. So we think that a spot Bitcoin product would be superior to all of these products because it really tracks. It's a very convenient, liquid, easy to use wrapper, how you can gain exposure into the digital asset space. And it would be supremely better than what is in the market. And we actually believe that if those products will be approved, and if Ether products as well, spot Ether products will be approved, they would take flows away from these futures and closed-end products, because they would be quite ideal, particularly for the advisory market. I believe advisory market is the largest market in the US that uses ETFs. So for them, it would be a very, very big deal indeed, because at the moment, it's quite difficult for them to invest in digital assets. So yes, so spot Bitcoin ETF would definitely be one big big driver. Of course, some positive regulatory developments as well, legislation in the US, a kind of framework for crypto assets would be another very positive sign. So those are probably the two most obvious ones related to the industry in kind of co in combination with the macro factors that I just indicated. So the improvement in liquidity, and perhaps lower interest rates.
Have you noticed the statistics using on-chain metrics that there's never been a higher proportion of Bitcoins that have been taken off exchanges and held long term? So people are hoarding Bitcoins. Now,
Yes.
if you were to have one of these ETFs approved, or several, there are several applications, someone has to go and find the Bitcoins to back the products, right? So doesn't that potentially create, I'm thinking about like the Hunt brothers cornering the market for silver. Isn't that like theoretically possible that somebody could go out there and Michael Saylor go and buy up all the Bitcoins and then say, I'm not selling them to you?
Yes, that's a very good point, Ben, because in Bitcoin we also will have the so-called Bitcoin halving event, which is expected in April of next year. And that is typically an event where the amount of new Bitcoin awarded to Bitcoin miners will get cut in half. So there will be less Bitcoin for those miners to sell. And historically, that has resulted in a significant bull market in the price of Bitcoin. And now, particularly if these two things take place at the same time, so you have maybe a spot Bitcoin ETF products approved in the US, and then if you have this Bitcoin halving event where the supply of Bitcoin will be lower, that could result in a very interesting supply-demand imbalance, which one would think could lead into a significant a price increase, if history is of any guidance. So yes, that is definitely something that we follow. And although we think that probably the because now close to 20 million bitcoins have already been mined out of the total of 21 million, so it is not exactly like it was in the beginning when the kind of proportionately the impact was greater. We still do think that it has an impact, but equally, the liquidity, the improved, if the liquidity improves, that will have an equally big impact on the space.
There was another event I was thinking about. I noticed a headline the other day that the shorts are going after US banks again. And we know part of the reason, well, we saw earlier in the year when banks started failing, they had a maturity mismatch on their municipal bonds, but also T-bills. Now, that situation hasn't changed really. But we know when that's happened, like Bitcoin price started moving. We could argue whether it's in part or fully due to those failures, but Bitcoin was created in to respond to banks failing and being bailed out. But do you think, have you been monitoring that situation still? And do you think that that could play a catalyst if we saw more banks collapsing?
Yes, absolutely. So definitely in March, what we saw is that at the time, investors viewed Bitcoin as a sort of long-term store of value, anti-fiat asset, not dependent on any central bank, fixed supply of Bitcoin available. So definitely also, I mean, our sort of discussions with investors indicated that some investors like to use Bitcoin as sort of a kind of a safe asset, long-term store of value in those cases. And I agree with you. I think a lot of those banking issues are still there. They haven't changed. And so what the Fed did was that they improved the liquidity situation. I mean, they didn't start quantitative easing in March, but they did improve the liquidity situation. And that is something that we're following very closely on whether Fed will do the same again to kind of ease the situation for the regional banks.
All right. Well, it should be an interesting 6 months. It's going to be a hard kind of outlook to put together because there's many possible things that can happen. And, you know, we know plenty of surprises lurk around corners. But interesting, that's a good or an interesting way to frame it. There needs to be a catalyst, something to jolt the market out of where it's at. I guess we'll see what happens. But we have been talking a lot about Bitcoin. Because it's interesting and it's a large proportion of the market. But in your outlook, you've written about Ethereum staking and kind of compared it to a few other benchmarks to assess whether how has staking gone so far. It's been live for 6 months, the ability to withdraw one's Ether. So we've now got a little bit of a track record. By no means is it definitive. What are your thoughts there around what's going on with Ether, its staking yield, and the macro context in which it exists?
Yeah, so what we have seen is that so the staking and unstaking is taking place as expected, so without any hiccups or problems. There are some small finalization issues, but nothing major, really. So it's basically working as expected. What we have observed is that the Ether staking yield, which was about 5%, I believe, in April when the unstaking was enabled, has gone down to, last time I looked, it was 3.4. And that's really because as you have more stakers in the network, more people willing to participate in the authentication of transactions, locking their ETH away, and being able to earn yield, kind of passive yield. So that yield is going down when you have a larger amount of validators. Normally, or most likely in the future, what will kind of compensate for that decline is an increase in the number of transactions on the Ethereum network. But what we have seen actually this year is that just recently, the number of transactions on Ethereum actually went to its lowest level this year. And we believe that that's due to many reasons, most likely because it hasn't yet moved to a scalability upgrade, so-called proto-dank sharding, which increases the throughput of the network. So at the moment, in its current original format, Ethereum cannot really handle a huge number of transactions. I believe it's just 15 to 30 transactions per second. Proto-dank sharding, which is expected to be implemented later this year, will increase this amount. So you will have cheaper transactions, higher throughput, and a larger amount of transactions that can be transmitted on the network. And so that is something that we're definitely expecting. There are some other factors that can also impact the yield, such as whether maximum extractable value, so-called MEV technology, is used, and a couple of others. But so what we have seen is that the yield has been going down, number of validators has been going up. So investors do think it is an interesting proposition to offer this passive yield. But we really would like to see this proto-dank sharding and then see whether developers who have used some of these other layer one smart contract layer one networks are moving to Ethereum, because that's actually what we've anecdotally heard, is that some of those layer ones that were created to compete with Ethereum in 2021, when the network was very slow, some of those haven't really been taken off. And then we have this Ethereum network, which is very modular. It's very attractive. It still has the largest amount of developers supporting it. So we really want to see whether some of those developers will move to Ethereum. And we think it's quite likely that they might actually do so. So we think that this yield will not just continue to go down, but it has a possibility to go up. And part of the reason why Ethereum has not been doing as well, or the price of Ethereum has not been doing as well as Bitcoin, is most likely related to this fact that we have a sort of 5.5% short-term treasury note yield, and you can get it risk-free. So some investors will go for that instead of potentially investing in Ethereum, where you get passive yield. So that's one factor. Then, of course, we have the other factor, which is that Coinbase came out earlier this, SEC came after Coinbase earlier this year, and they said that actually staking as a service is a security, and the SEC has not been willing to categorize Ethereum yet. So they've said that, in their view, Bitcoin is a commodity, but they, particularly the chairman of the SEC, Gary Gensler, despite several questions being asked of him and repeatedly at a recent hearing, he was not willing to categorize Ethereum to a commodity or a security. So there's this uncertainty around staking and then also what Ethereum might be. That could be another reason why we're seeing this kind of weakness for this particular moment of time.
Yeah, there's so many different dynamics. One of them that you were talking about there, you know, as the throughput of the network is increased, will there be enough demand for transactions, block space, but enough demand to use the network? Because ultimately, it's people who pay the transaction fees that reward the validators, well, in part. There's all of these layer two things happening. We had someone from Base on the other week, so I'm not going to go into depth there, but they kind of divert users away and take fees that don't, they get paid to the Ethereum network, but not the sum total that all of the users would have paid had they not used the layer two. It's the simplest way to put it. You mentioned at the top of the show, though, and I think it's a good one to talk about, which is where could demand for Ethereum block space come from? And you said that there are a lot of TradFi firms out there who are now starting to use the Ethereum network, usually in proof of concepts, but some of them have got things live. What's your kind of view on what's going on there? Because we've got a long-term thesis that this crypto space and the traditional finance spaces will merge. The lines are already blurring. What is it that's caught your eye in recent months that suggests this transitional process is occurring?
Yes. So I would say that a lot of perhaps the most used or popular use cases are really tokenized currencies. So like tokenized US dollar, so-called stable coins, that's $120 billion market approximately. Then you also have Ethereum networks being used for tokenizing different real world assets, funds, or many TradFi companies are actually using tokenization to improve efficiency, use it for settlements, use it for kind of immediate collateral, etc., which tokenization enables. And also some particularly private assets are being put on blockchain, oftentimes Ethereum, but it could be some other blockchains as well. And that is one way how you can expand the client base for your assets, because typically in alternatives, you have a fairly high minimum to invest. It could be 5 or 10 million to invest in a fund. But if you tokenize an alternative investment fund, you can actually lower the minimum and you can offer the product to a wider customer base. So that is something that we've actually already seen with some alternative managers. So at the moment, it's really along those lines. But ultimately, it will really be, the true mass market, we believe, can only truly emerge when you have the scalability of the networks where the transactions take place in seconds and they cost just pennies, when the user interface is easy to use, probably in a way where you don't have to interact with private keys or wallets or browsers or updating of them. But you could maybe just use your credit card, pay it monthly, to pay for the transaction fees on blockchains. And if those are experiments that are now being, or companies that are experimenting with those types of solutions. And then finally, also, when we move into the Web3 world, where we have several different types of blockchains, we really need to have the digital identity and privacy. So we need to have technologies which enable us to use technologies in a way where we don't have to constantly keep sharing our private information with the rest of the world, but we can get kind of attested, approved in some way where we get a digital identity, and then we can move around with that digital identity without sharing our private information. And also that kind of stage of blockchains and internet would mean that end users would have more control over over the data, over the value of their assets. So the whole idea of that Web3 world is that we can transmit value globally. Internet today enables us to transmit information globally, but at that point we would be able to transmit value, all types of digital value globally. And that really needs this kind of digital identity and significant privacy improvements over the current solutions. And those are all three areas that are under development right now, which gives us a lot of confidence that we will, in the next bull market, we're most likely to see some really interesting applications. Because at the end of the day, it will really be an application that the clients really want to use. They might not even know it's based on blockchain, but it's just superbly better than anything else they've used before.
Yeah, it's our guest who came from Base last time, we ended the episode and talked in broad terms about the topics you just raised. So there is some consensus emerging. I noticed Vitalik Buterin put out Future of Ethereum, What It Needs, and mentioned those topics. This was a few months ago. You're watching like an open source. There's no one leader, right? We know there are certain entities that have got like more clout than others, but there's no one leader. And as they all start moving in certain directions, you can start anticipating what's coming down the pike. I know the account abstraction space is very busy right now because I've got to map it out. The privacy piece. We had Jill on from Espresso Systems recently, and they did some work on what they call CAPE, which was using zero knowledge proofs. And then, the scalability piece. There's lots of different groups working on different solutions, but they all seem about right. And ultimately they have to deliver, as you say, something that's actually useful to people. It can't just be a silly musical chairs token game, which we've seen in the past. It does have to be something that delivers something useful. And that's why watching the TradFi firms move in is worth noting. They used to try and build their own private permission chain thing that you get none of the benefits of the open network, but you do get an increase in your IT budget. And they've slowly started to come around to the open protocol benefits. It'd take them time, but if they can start moving some of that genuine economic activity on chain, then we will start to see some benefits that haven't accrued in the past, but you'll get the best of both worlds, which should be cheaper, faster, more convenient, more transparent, and financial services activity and other activity, as you know, like in the gaming space, in Asia in particular. But we are coming up on time, so it's time to close out. Usually finish the episodes by asking our guests like anything else they have their eye on. You have to have your eye on a lot of things, most of which we've covered today. But is there anything else that you think listeners should be or could be interested in monitoring over the coming months?
Yes, I think just recently, I think this week, there have been some articles about Binance again. So it is the world's largest offshore exchange, still handles a large part of the perpetual futures and also big part of the spot trading. So there's been some talk about their BNB token, which is like an exchange token, utility token, Kind of the talk about is about going back to their original ICO and how they might not have actually raised as much money as they claimed. And so that is something that I'll keep a very close eye on what happens there, because Binance is a key liquidity provider in this space. So we definitely do need to follow what goes on with Binance. And you obviously have SEC, CFTC in the US, as well as the US Justice Department, who has gone after Binance on and announced all kinds of allegations against it. So it is something to monitor,
Yeah.
probably the biggest issue to monitor.
Good point. They have been withdrawing from a lot of markets bit by bit, so retreating. One argument would be you try and move to more profitable segments. The other would be now it's become too scary to be there.
Yes, and I think in general, I think the trend is toward more kind of regulated onshore exchanges. I think the role of offshore exchanges is probably going to diminish over time. So we had earlier this year, we had the introduction of EDX Markets, which is an institutional crypto exchange, and that's backed by some of the TradFi companies. So I think that's really created for the institutional market. So we think that those kinds of offshore unregulated exchanges are more risky, particularly for the big institutional market and advisor market.
All right, well, we'll see how the regulatory landscape evolves. A path towards being compliant in a jurisdiction is one big piece of not going offshore to begin with. And while we're out of time today, perhaps next time we can assess any changes in the landscape in Europe. By that time, MiCA should have gone in place. We can take another look at the US, but also maybe we have a look at the Emirates or Singapore or Hong Kong, because that's also a piece of the space that is crucial, as you've said twice today. But unfortunately, we don't have time to cover it. You can never have enough time to cover things here. There's so many interesting things to talk about in this space. Minerva, where can people find the material that you publish for WisdomTree? I know it's the WisdomTree site, but is there a specific place they should look?
Yeah, so WisdomTree, crypto digital asset pages and crypto strategy, I believe it's called. So there's a lot of information there. I also publish most of the things on my LinkedIn profile.
All right, there you go, folks. With that, we are unfortunately out of time, but I hope everyone found today's podcast useful and informative. US listeners, WisdomTree Prime, check it out, wisdomtreeprime.com or the Apple and Android app stores. You can find me at Benjamin Dean on the Bird app. Thank you again for listening. Minerva, thank you for taking part today. I hope everyone has a great day.
Thank you, Ben.